food eaters. How are you doing? It's time for another Food Labels Revealed podcast. It's episode number 89. I'm your host, Mel Weinstein, your self-absorbed, self-possessed, and self-professed prophet of processed foods. As I mentioned in the last episode, I've decided to change up this show by pivoting to something different, something I'm calling a biographical podcast, a multi-episode program about a person who has radically changed our experience of commercial food. For the first serial, I've chosen to present the life of John Harvey Kellogg, the inventor of cornflakes. Yeah, cornflakes. Who altered how many Americans ate their breakfast in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and to this day. History is full of ironies, and here we have one of them. John Harvey Kellogg, despite gifting cornflakes to the world, did not start the Kellogg's Cereal Company. We will learn about that mysterious fact later in the program, but of course you could just go straight to Wikipedia and be done with it, but I suggest that you don't spoil it for yourself and just follow this tale as it unfolds, so you'll get the full story with all the background details. John Harvey Kellogg was actually a medical doctor, a surgeon, a health reformer, a famous author and speaker, an inventor, an industrialist, and one of the most famous people in America at the beginning of the 20th century. At one point, a national survey placed him as the second most famous American, just behind a U.S. president, Herbert Hoover. Kellogg wore many hats. He was even nominated for a Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology. Plus, he seemed to live forever with an abundance of energy and creativity right up to the very end, despite being pretty sick as a kid. It's fitting that this first biographical podcast is about a cereal inventor, since the very first FLR episode in 2016 was entitled Breakfast, Kellogg's versus Mom's Cereals. I started by talking about the ingredients in cereals because, more than any other type of packaged food, they dominated the inside aisles of grocery stores. Clearly, they had a dominating influence on what Americans ate by virtue of the massive number of options in that cereal aisle. Back then, I counted 658 choices of different brands and different package sizes of hot and cold cereals. That number probably hasn't changed much today. There are still lots of choices, but sadly, very few healthy ones. For this series, I've relied heavily on two books mentioned in the show notes, plus various internet resources such as Wikipedia. There is a ton of information about Dr. Kellogg since he had so many fingers and so many pies, but I've tried to distill his life and times down to the essential and most interesting details. It's a bit of Americana. Early medicine practices, New Age health alternatives, burgeoning food manufacturing, and the incessant drive of many Americans to seek out long and healthy lives in spite of uncooperative environments, much like the current times. So, let me introduce the series with part one called Family History. I'll turn it over to Dr. John Harvey Kellogg. Let me introduce myself. John Harvey Kellogg. It's an honor, quite an honor, to be on this program. I've been asked to tell my personal story. I've had a life full of adventure, travel, education, acclamation, criticism, great joys, great sadnesses, phenomenal gains, terrible losses, along with a few tragedies. It's been quite the ride. Now, this newfangled technology called podcasting, it's a wonder to me, but I've always enjoyed new technologies. This podcasting thing, I have no idea really how it works. With my crude understanding, it's something like radio with wavelengths of light carrying audio information that gets beamed into the heavens and somehow gets transmitted back to Earth and replayed on people's personal devices anywhere on the planet. It's crazy. What a fabulous technology. If it was available in my day, I definitely would have been first in line to purchase it. Well, let's get to my story, which I'll tell in bits and pieces. The logical place to start is my family history. It shaped and formed me in so many ways. That history was told and retold and retold as I was growing up. Now, there may be some holes in it due to lapses in my memory, but I'll retell it here as best as I can. My ancestors emigrated from Essex County in Great Britain in the mid-1600s. Yes, that's well over 400 years ago. They settled in Connecticut, but eventually moved to the city of Hadley, Massachusetts, where they stayed until my father, the young John Preston Kellogg, the seventh son in a pretty poor family, decided to cast his lot as a farmer in the western frontier. To check out that region, he first took a trip by himself to the Chicago area in Northeast Illinois, as it's called today. He was sorely disappointed. The soil was poor. The land was swampy with a bunch of mosquitoes. And as a devout Christian, he was disturbed by the unsavory people he met there. After returning home, my father learned about a settlement further north in the territory of Michigan, begun by some New Englanders several years earlier. He then decided that that was the place for he and his family to put down roots. The year was 1834. Now, John Preston, my father, had a wife, Mary, and two small sons, Merritt and Smith. In the summer, they loaded up a wagon with their worldly possessions and headed for Albany, New York, their first destination, about 96 miles away. There, John Preston sold his team of horses, and the family boarded a boat on the eastern terminus of the Erie Canal. That waterway carried them to Buffalo, New York, about 360 miles away. Now, from there, they boarded a steamboat to cross Lake Erie. The four-day journey finally brought them to Detroit. After purchasing another wagon, farm equipment, tools, and food, the family moved northwest for 60 miles on a rugged frontier road until they reached the area of Flint, where they met up with a former Hadley neighbor to talk about settling there and purchasing land. My father eventually learned that there was still plenty of government-owned land to be had in that part of the territory of Michigan. So he filed a claim on 320 acres that already had a one-room log cabin on it. Immediately, he started clearing land to begin a farm that eventually produced crops such as wheat, corn, oats, and buckwheat. Eventually, with the help of neighbors, a barn was raised. Now, winters in that part of Michigan were brutal, very brutal, and trying to stay warm in a little log cabin without a good fireplace was very challenging, to say the least. Life on the frontier was difficult, if not dangerous. After that first winter, my father built another log cabin, more spacious this time, with two upstairs bedrooms. Next to the new cabin, he built a stable to house horses and cows. The following year, he built a brick oven for baking bread. Life was getting a little easier on the family, but tragedy loomed around the corner. From 1836 to 1840, his wife Mary bore three more children, one son and two daughters. Caring for five children and all the household chores took its toll on Mary. She was all these things: a weaver, tailor, dressmaker, leather tanner, shoemaker, harness maker, cook, housekeeper, wife, and mother. Their Christian faith was very strong, which led them to oppose slavery. They became station agents for the Underground Railroad, helping runaway slaves to pass through Michigan for freedom in Canada. This was a dangerous endeavor, particularly due to the Fugitive Slave Act, which was passed later in 1850. That law carried a penalty of 6 months jail time and a stiff fine of $1,000. In today's money, that's $40,000. Well, to come full circle, in 1883, Sojourner Truth, abolitionist, author, women's rights activist, and former slave, became one of my patients in Battle Creek, Michigan. She died in that same year and was buried in a Battle Creek cemetery. Her funeral was reported to be the largest ever held in that town. Sadly, Mary's health began to fail. 3 years after the move to Flint area, she began to have severe coughing spells and spit up lots of blood. She was diagnosed with consumption, a complex of symptoms that mainly affected the lungs. That disease was later called tuberculosis, or as we know it today, TB, a bacterial infection. But the cause wasn't worked out until much later in the 1880s with the advent of germ theory in medicine. There was, at that time, no cure for that malady. Unfortunately, it was also contagious, and most probably, Mary infected other members of her family. Now, she became so incapacitated in the final 4 months of her life that she asked my father to hire a neighbor's teenage daughter, Ann Jeanette Stanley, to be a nanny to her five young children. Eventually, sadly, in September 1841, after several years of suffering and just 7 years after arriving in Michigan, Mary experienced a severe lung hemorrhage, lost copious amounts of blood, and died just a few days short of her 30th birthday. There was more bad news for my family, since Ann Stanley, the woman who was nannying, had to quit. She had taken a teaching job at a local school, so that fall and winter, my father had to take care of his large family all by himself. But he didn't give up. He persisted in seeking Ann's help. So later in the spring of 1842, Ann agreed to come back to the farm with one stipulation. They were to marry, and she would become both a wife and a stepmother. John Preston, at 36, was twice Ann's age. Years later, which is good news, she gave birth to me. Now, 9 months after their marriage, John Preston and Ann decided to move to a new location. It was kind of strange, but they wound up swapping farms with a neighbor's son who wanted to move back to be near his family. The new place they got was a 160-acre farm in Livingston County with all the buildings on it that they needed. My father expanded his crops to include red clover, fruit trees, currants, vegetables, and even added a flock of sheep. They did very well on this new farm, and 10 years out, they were one of the most prosperous enterprises in the neighborhood. Between 1843 and 1866, Anne, my mother, gave birth to 11 children. Yes, 11 babies. I was their fifth child, born in 1852. Of my 11 siblings, 4 of them died at a young age of infectious diseases. Still, the house seemed always full of children. My mother, Anne, faced with so much death in her family, became very distrusting of medical doctors who repeatedly failed to diagnose and treat her children successfully. More and more, she leaned on alternative treatments like hydrotherapy, using water's healing powers. Back in the middle 1800s, medical knowledge, particularly on the frontier, was really in the dark ages. The average lifespan for a man was about 39, and for a woman, about 41 years. Doctors were not well trained in those times. Most medicines were ineffective. Surgery, without the benefit of anesthesia, was very risky and painful. Sterilization techniques were non-existent, so infections were common. Diagnostic techniques were unreliable and often only looked at in terms of bodily fluids, such as vomit, urine, bile, and stools, looking at those for signs of some kind of disease. A common purgative, that is a laxative, was calomel. Its chemical name is mercury chloride. Mercury, we know very well today, is a heavy metal toxin, but its extreme health hazards were not known back then. It particularly affects the brain and nervous system. Now, for pain, addictive opium was often used. To treat heart ailments, 2 other poisons were utilized, strychnine and arsenic. To combat inflammation, the old treatment of bloodletting was still used at that time. Medical training in the United States did not greatly improve until I received my education some 25 years later. Probably because of what I saw as a kid, I never was a big proponent of medications in my career, but rather I chose to give the body what it needed to heal itself. I'll address that topic in detail much later in this story. My family was very religious. One would call them today Christian evangelists. They were active in the movement known as the Second Great Awakening, which was mainly promoted by itinerant preachers who traveled around the country holding emotional revival meetings and promising adherents that the second coming of Christ was imminent. From 1852 to 53, just after I was born, my father became unhappy with the local Christian church in Tyrone, Michigan. He came under the influence of Joseph Bates, who was a charismatic, traveling preacher, giving sermons at the time in nearby Jackson. Bates was promoting a new Christian sect called the Seventh-day Adventists. Now, that name comes from the fact that the followers took Sabbath on Saturday, the seventh day of the week, similar to the Hebrews in the Old Testament. Adventists were believers in the Advent, that is, the second coming, which they expected to see during their lifetime. My father, mother, and older brothers then shortly joined the new church. Of course, that church became my place of worship and later had a profound influence on the course of my life. Because of their new church, my parents decided to sell their thriving farm and move to Jackson, Michigan to be closer to the church. My father's family had been into broom-making back in Connecticut, so he decided to start that kind of business in Jackson. At the same time, my father donated some of the money from the sale of his farm to the church, so their publishing company, called the Review and Herald, could be moved from Rochester, New York, to Battle Creek, Michigan, about 500 miles. The publications of that press provided essential income to the growing church. Then, 4 years later, my family moved once more, this time to Battle Creek, roughly 40 miles from Jackson. Battle Creek, by then, was becoming the headquarters of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. My father opened a small store and a broom factory there. It was in Battle Creek that I came under the influence of the church leaders James and Ellen White, who became like second parents to me. You'll get to know them in the next chapter when I talk to you about my boyhood. Later. Mel here. I just want to fill in a few historical details from Dr. Kellogg's family history. First, the Erie Canal that the Kelloggs used to reach Buffalo, New York, and Lake Erie was an engineering marvel of its day. Completed in 1832 over a 7-year period, the 15-foot-wide canal was the second longest in the world at 363 miles. Many tons of dirt were excavated, hundreds of locks were built, and many special canal boats were constructed, both for the rich and the poor passengers. Those boats were pulled along at around 5 miles per hour, with rigging attached to teams of horses or mules who were walking along a designated towpath on the north side of the canal. A complicated procedure had to be followed if two boats encountered each other from opposite directions to keep all the lines from getting tangled. The efficiency of the Erie Canal, with its 24/7 schedule, cut the conventional stagecoach time for this trip by almost 50%. Passengers, numbering around 40 at capacity, slept and ate on the packet boats. The average distance traveled was around 52 miles each day. The use of the Erie Canal for transportation was eventually eclipsed by railroads, highways, and motorized vehicles, but it was still in use in the 20th century. Nowadays, it's primarily used for recreational purposes in the various cities and towns that it passes through. Second, the land that John Preston Kellogg purchased for farming when first arriving in Flint, Michigan, was provided by the federal government. It was part of the territory of Michigan, which encompassed much more than the present-day state. It stretched from parts of northern Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois to Wisconsin, to the eastern parts of the Dakotas, and south to Iowa. Most of the land was seized by cession and force from the native tribes in the region between 1795 and 1842. The Ottawa, the Potawatomi, the Ojibwa, and the Wyandot peoples. The sale of this land to settlers from the east was the major source of income for the U.S. Treasury in the early 1800s. At a cost of $1.25 per acre, which is about $46 in today's money. It was a real steal. Listeners, that's it for now. I hope you enjoyed this first installment of The Serial King, a biographical podcast. Please share it if you found it interesting and educational. In the next episode, we'll hear from Dr. Kellogg about his upbringing and how he got steered into the medical profession. To all my followers in podcast land, old and new, I appreciate you tuning in. I greatly appreciate a 5-star rating and positive review at the iTunes store. I read all of them. You can find previous episodes of Food Labels Revealed and their show notes at the hosting website called Podbean. That's at www.podbean.com, or just by Googling Food Labels Revealed. And, of course, you can always listen to the podcast on your smartphone or tablet by downloading a podcast app like Apple Podcasts or Google Play or Spotify. If you think your family, friends, coworkers, or acquaintances might be interested in this podcast, tweet or post a link through your social media outlets to get the word out. If you haven't already, check out my recently published book on Amazon by searching on my name, Mel Weinstein, or the title, Fast Food Ingredients Revealed. Till later, remember this. If you want to eat well and keep yourself healthy, eat food mainly from natural plants, not manufacturing plants. The outro music piece is Turkey in the Straw, a popular tune of the late 19th century.
Good, but one of her legs was made of wood. Her hair was false and her teeth was too, and there wasn't much for me to do.
Turkey in the straw,
a turkey in the hay,
a turkey in the straw.
What did you say?
Hey,
roll and twist them up high at the claw.
Hitty half a tune called Turkey in the Straw.
I'm just like a goose. I chew snooze to beat the deuce. She says, what's the use to chew that snooze when you got to spit out most of the juice?
A turkey in the straw,
a turkey in the grass,
a turkey in the straw.
I get a kick out of this. Roll them, twist them up a high attack hall.
Hit a tune called Turkey in the Straw.